History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the 1800 presidential election, when President John Adams faced his own vice president, Thomas Jefferson, it was perhaps the nastiest election the United States had ever seen. It was very similar to 2020, where there was partisan rancor, there were personal insults between the candidates, and a really politicized media, way more than what you would have seen in the mid-20th century. John Adams was described by Thomas Jefferson's hatchet men as a repulsive pedant, and a gross hypocrite who behaved neither like a man nor like a woman, but possessed a hideous hermaphroditical character. Jefferson was the hatchet man, and critics of him said that he was of Indian stock and was a mean-spirited, low-lived fellow who had created a nation where murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest would be openly taught and practiced. Today's guest is Jeffrey Sakinga, the Ashland Institute, and he argues that 2020, although it's a very intense election, it was nothing compared to 1800, so America has been through rough election seasons before, and we can look to the past to understand what's going to happen to us in the future. Part of the fear of 1800 was that America would not be able to outlast this election. Sakinga says that only 24 years after the Declaration of Independence proclaimed that Americans were one people, it looked like America could be torn apart. The Constitution was only 12 years old, and the unifying figure of George Washington, who was unanimously elected twice, had died the year before in 1799. Washington warned about the dangers of parties in his farewell address, but despite this, two competing parties had formed, the Federalists of Adams and the Democratic Republicans of Jefferson. Power had rarely been transferred peacefully between two rival parties in any nation, and that's still the case today. And there had never been a peaceful transfer of power from one party to another in the new country. But despite all this, America surprised the world. Jefferson won, and Adams, even though he was bitter at what he regarded as Jefferson's betrayal of him, followed the Constitution and stepped aside peacefully. For his part in his inaugural address, Jefferson implored his fellow citizens of the United States to unite together with one heart and one mind, and he said to restore social intercourse and the harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. Jefferson believed that Americans would be able to rise above the bitter acrimony. He said they were the brethren of the same principle, and the truths they shared in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, equality, liberty, and consent of the government, and the rule of law would bind them together. So in this episode, Jeff and I discuss the similarities between 1800 and today, how the media back then was actually much more bitter and much more partisan than it is now, how people felt acrimony toward one another. But the United States was able to survive 1800, and he thinks it'll survive 2020 because there is still a deep understanding of the Constitution, and it provides an immune system of the body politic to be able to handle viruses that would try to affect us today. So there's reason for optimism, but also a call to continue to understand the constitutional principles that allow the United States to survive 1800 and why it can survive even now in the face of threats of a bitter race between two people, a very divided media, and even threats of things like court packing that Franklin D. Roosevelt tried in the 1930s and what some people are talking about today. So a lot to get into. 1800 has never been as relevant as it is now. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Jeffrey Sakinga. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very excited to talk about the election of 1800 because it has some of the best quotes and the best attack lines in American political history. And I like to think that if your politics can't be nicer, they should at least be more eloquent. And a famous line here that Thomas Jefferson's hatchet men use against John Adams was that Adams was a repulsive pedant and gross hypocrite who behaved neither like a man nor like a woman, but instead possessed a hideous hermaphroditical character. And then Adams' hatchet men replied in kind that Jefferson was a mean-spirited, low-lived fellow would create a nation where murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will openly be taught and practiced. So any other choice lines like that come to your mind when they were attacking each other?
Oh, yeah, there's so many. Going off that one that you just read on the hermaphroditical character of John Adams, the rest of the quote is, "He has neither the gentleness of a woman nor the firmness of a man." And Jefferson, really, actually, well, the first time publicly that rumors were spread about Jefferson and Sally Hemings, his the enslaved woman on Monticello Plantation, that was came out from Adams' henchmen in the election of 1800. So that was the first time it was spread out to the world and used as really dirty attack on Jefferson. Yeah, Jefferson, one of Jefferson's henchmen also said Adams belonged to the aristocratical, monarchical Anglican party, of all things. Yeah, yeah. John Adams, who fought for independence against the king, was a secret monarchist.
And if I remember correctly, were people trying to spread insinuations that Jefferson was part Native American in his background, or was it his offspring? I can't remember which one.
No, that he himself was of uncertain fatherage was the phrase, which was a way of saying that he had illegitimate birth, maybe to some other tribe or race.
Right. And to be fair, those attacks are below the belt, but John Adams, for all of his brilliance, was an ugly man. And Thomas Jefferson, based on his dalliances, dig things that could make you question his background and the background of his offspring. So I like to think there's some historical nuggets of truth in there. But the main point that you're going after when you wrote a column for USA Today and the way that you've researched this is that you're trying to show that the election of 1800 was in many ways nastier than 2020 in terms of partisanship, in terms of media rancor, politicized media. So could you enter us into that world of 1800, and what are things that in 2020 would shock us about that election?
Yeah, I think there's some remarkable things about that election in 1800. One of which is people have to remember the candidates themselves didn't campaign. So all the nasty stuff, all the dirty stuff could actually be said, it was in some ways even dirtier and nastier because the candidates themselves didn't have to say it and never had to take responsibility for it. They both Adams and Jefferson pretended that their henchmen had said, they had no idea that their henchmen were saying such things. Now, we know in the case of Jefferson for sure that he did know of these things, or at least knew sort of what was going to be said. It's even possible that he was feeding information to some of these newspaper guys, or at least through his subordinates. But they were, I think, in some ways, because they didn't have to take responsibility for those remarks, and the press in those days made no pretense to being objective. If you were a Federalist, you read certain papers. If you were a Democratic Republican, you read certain papers. Some occasionally tried to be a little bit balanced, but generally the media was understood to be very partisan. So they weren't restrained by personal responsibility, and they weren't really restrained by sort of media ethics that we have come to think of in 2020. So I think that in part accounts for the fact that you see these guys in their portraits look like dignified characters. How could they have had such a dirty campaign? And I think that helps to explain it in part.
Yeah, and I'd like to follow up on the media, because today in 2020, there's a lot of discussion about how our fragmented media means that not everyone is considering the other person's opposing view, which is a problem, I agree. But I think a lot of people assume that the press that we have, it's not something that harkens back to the Declaration of Independence. It's really a post-World War II institution where a large city has one urban daily that at least had the pretense of being objective. And you can argue about how well it did that, but that model seems to be fragmented. And now you have the blogosphere and people are siloed into their own information centers. What was 1800 like? Is it similar to what we're getting into in the social media blogosphere where there's different cul-de-sacs, or was it different in some ways? What did that look like?
You know, it's remarkable. It looks a lot like what 2020 has become. You had a few major newspapers that more or less were sort of broad in their, I don't want to say they were impartial or objective, but they were broader than just merely attack newspapers. But then you had a lot of small-time newspapers, a lot of pamphlets. People forget pamphleteering was a big thing during the American Revolution, during the Constitution, and in the election of 1800. And it's a lot like today. You know, a lot of people, yourself included, can enter the media market because the barriers to entry are so much lower than they used to. You don't have to have a lot of capital to get involved and be in the media and be a serious journalist who's really engaged in great conversation. It's just like back then. If you knew a friend who had a printing press, you could run off hundreds of copies of a pamphlet and get it out there. So pamphleteering in many ways is sort of like the podcast or the blogosphere of today, with lots of people doing it.
Well, that's very interesting. Because I think the past can maybe give us a sense of what the future will be like, because I can only see the media becoming more fragmented. And let's compare 1800 this time, where you have large dailies, but then you have pamphleteers, printing presses, a robust media, compared to, let's say, 1956, where I would wake up in the morning, smoke my pipe, put on my slippers and my cardigan sweater, and see what the New York Bugle has to say about Dwight D. Eisenhower or whatever, where this our imagination of the height of the commanding heights of media top down, where things were very monocultural. So compared to like 1956 media versus 1800, what are the good things about 1966 and the good things and bad things? What are the good and bad on both sides?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I think, as you said before, we tend to think the media world of a few big daily newspapers that are national in scope, and then maybe three networks, you know, and the day, ABC, CBS, NBC, just three big networks. We tend to think that's the norm for media. But that was, as you said, just a post-World War II phenomenon. And it's really an aberration. It's not the rule. It's the exception to the rule in American media. So, look, that did have some good aspects to it, that you could, there was media made a pretense, at least, of being objective. Now, no one's ever objective, but they can be fair, right? Journalists can be fair. And I think that that's an important aspect of journalistic and media ethics. Everybody starts from a certain perspective, but they can be open to hear the other side and engage in conversation and even argument with them because they're trying to get at the truth. And that idea of trying to get at the truth in media, I think that's an important aspect of the ethos of post-World War II media. The problem was, as we've come to learn, it turned out that was not always true, especially when certain elements in society got control of those big media corporations and started to slant the news in certain directions, that people began to realize, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure I'm getting the truth. So the very thing that allowed them to kind of, that centralized aspect that allowed them to be able to say the truth to the American people was the thing, I think, that also allowed it, once that got corrupted, to be clearly biased, and which has led to the proliferation of now all kinds of media that sort of push back against that. The only thing I would say is, that I wouldn't quite call it fragmented, the media. It's right. It's certainly true. I prefer to think of it as decentralized. That you know, Americans might want to go to one particular source for some of their news, but it's amazing how many Americans still go to listen to different outlets of media for their news, and they'll get news in lots of different ways. It's possible to insulate yourself from stuff you don't want to hear, but it's amazing the extent to which surveys show that Americans still do hear things they don't want to hear, and sometimes they even seek it out themselves. So there's a bit of balance, I think, still. And, you know, I think that's a lot healthier in the long run for America than three news medias and two national journals that just tell everybody what the story is.
Well, there's another parallel too, of course, between 2020 and 1800, and there's a new sense of fear in 2020 that the constitutional foundations of the United States can be challenged. And there's different fears on both the left and the right, that the legitimacy of Previously, apolitical institutions are becoming heavily politicized, like the Supreme Court and elsewhere. And I'd like you to take us back to 1800. What were the fears at that time? Was there a fear that the people think the partisanship is so horrible that America is going to be completely obliterated? Or were they not as concerned? Do they have different concerns? What did it look like?
No, that's a great question. I actually think that the concerns in 1800 were deeper than the concerns in 2020. As hard as that might seem for people to believe here in 2020, so near the election. But in 1800, you had the Adams Federalists, and particularly what were called the High Federalists, people like Alexander Hamilton and Charles Pinckney and others, who actually thought John Adams was a little too moderate. Those people, they have helped push, for example, to get the Alien and Sedition Acts passed in 1798, which they used then to suppress dissent and argument on the Democratic-Republican side. Those people really feared that Jefferson and his people would bring the French Revolution to America. They really feared that it would completely overthrow decency and order and ordered liberty in society. So they saw these people as radical Jacobins, French revolutionaries, who were going to take that revolution, spread it in America, and destroy the good constitutional order that America had just created. And they thought there's the only way they're going to get away with that is because George Washington had died in 1799. And so this great figure that had unified a sort of forces of disorder and disunion, he was dead. And so they thought Jefferson's going to try and get away with this and succeed. So on the Federalist side, you had people saying they're going to destroy America from within with this radical revolutionary talk. And on the other side, the Democratic Republic, his people really believed that Alexander Hamilton was behind the scenes being a puppet master, pulling John Adams' strings, and was trying to turn the United States into a monarchy or something like the British political system, which they regarded as completely contrary to the Declaration of Independence, to the Constitution, and to the idea of being a republic. So you had really like totally different visions of America. At least they imagined that they each side had totally different visions of America and really were going to destroy the country.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, obviously that didn't happen. And that Jefferson wins in 1800 and Adams takes it very personally, the attacks that are probably sanctioned by Jefferson. But Adams steps down peacefully. He follows the Constitution, and Jefferson implores his fellow citizens to unite with one heart and one mind. And he says, restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are arbitrary things. What made it so that 1800, the transfer of power happened peacefully? Was it because of constitutional safeguards? Was it because of the personalities where Jefferson very well, had he wanted to, could have unleashed a Jacobin revolution, but because of his upstanding character and belief in constitutional principles, didn't? Or even if he wanted to, he couldn't because of the Constitution? Why did 1800 work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Jefferson actually called it the Revolution of 1800, meaning that the American Revolution had been complete, but also because never in the history of America and very rarely in the history of the world had power been transferred peacefully between two opposing political parties. You know, that didn't happen under Washington because he was unanimously elected twice as president. So this was one of those moments where people weren't actually sure it was going to happen. We take this for granted now, the peaceful transfer of power, because the precedent was really set in 1800. And it's a great question, you know, why? How come we had a peaceful transfer of power? I think the factors you point to, I think it's several, and I think you've mentioned all of them. One is Washington set the precedent that it's a constitutional office from which you should step aside when your time is up. He did that himself when he could have easily been reelected, but he did it. So Washington's powerful example was part of it. I think even though there was this heated and overheated rhetoric in the campaign of 1800, I think both sides agreed that the Constitution was something important that really had to be followed if America was ever going to have a chance at actually being stable and flourishing. That they remembered what it was like under the Articles of Confederation and before when there was chaos, and they didn't want to repeat that. So I think there's a kind of principled commitment and lesson learned from the past. And I also think you're right. It's the personalities of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, that they were both statesmen. And they kind of rose above the partisan moment and said to their partisan followers, no, we have to follow the peaceful transition of power. We have to follow the Constitution. We can't carry out political revenge against our enemies like some of Jefferson's followers wanted to do. They were bigger men than that. And I think part of it is, honestly, that they had been in the fight for independence together in 1776. And Jefferson never forgot that about Adams. When people were saying terrible things about Adams, even some of which Jefferson permitted to happen, in his heart of hearts, he always believed, and he has this wonderful line in his inaugural address where he says this, he always believed that they were what he calls brethren of the same principle, which is that they fundamentally, in their heart of hearts, believed in the principles of the Declaration of Independence. They had stood and fought for them. They had risked their lives for them. And I think that the memory of those times that they were together for both men gave them a kind of understanding with each other that persisted through that really nasty election.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I'm also curious about stepping outside of the political parties and looking at the population at large. Did it seem like they were mobilized against each other, the partisans, the Federalists and Anti-Federalists? And after the election was over, how did those feelings of animosity against each other dissipate? And I'm thinking now about 2020, where different people are seeing yard signs. Sometimes there's violence against other people at political rallies. So what happened to the population during the 1800 election and after the election?
Well, they did get heated up, and then they did cool off. That's the good news, partly because the Jeffersonian Party won a pretty resounding victory. So there was now, again, we have to remember, though, anybody who's seen the musical Hamilton knows that the election of 1800, right, ends up being actually between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. And I think part of the reason, because they've both got the same number of electoral votes, because they didn't vote separately for vice president and president. They weren't a ticket. They voted separately for them. And Aaron Burr refused to step aside. And so they had this tense moment. And it was actually Alexander Hamilton and John Adams who helped get Thomas Jefferson elected. Because even though they despised his principles, as Hamilton said, at least he has principles. We don't know this about Aaron Burr. So I think one of the reasons why the country could come back together was Jefferson and his allies had a certain bit of gratitude for Hamilton and Adams and the Federalists for helping to get Jefferson elected over Aaron Burr. And that transferred to the population at large. So things heated up, but because of that unusual moment, it cooled off. The population went back to doing what Americans do, which is going about their lives, trying to build businesses, prospering, and all the good things that people do. And that, I think, settled in over the next 10, 12 years. But regional differences didn't die. You know, in 1812, the New England states, which were still Federalist at the time, largely Federalist, actually threatened to secede from the Union over the War of 1812, for which they blamed Jefferson and Madison. So there were regional differences that remained below the surface powerfully, but things did subside and cool off in the general population for at least a decade.
Well, part of why you focused on this, you wrote about the election of 1800, is because of the parallels of today. Based on the election of 1800 and the aftermath, what do you think are some scenarios for 2020?
Yeah, I think one really important thing we learned in the election of 1800 and the precedent that it set is we have to follow the Constitution. The loser has to step aside or concede, as the case may be, and there has to be a peaceful transition of power. And I think that custom, that tradition, that habit is really powerfully ingrained in the American people. So I'm actually not a pessimist who's alarmed at the idea that if the election doesn't go the way the Republicans or the Democrats want, there's going to be chaos in the streets and violence and all this kind of stuff. There might be on the fringes, of course, but the vast majority of Americans accept that if your person loses, then you've lost. And then you fight again the next election in 2 years, or you fight again in the next presidential election in 4 years. I think that tradition is really still a very powerful part of the American people, and they respect that constitutional norm. And I, for one, don't foresee the kind of chaos that some people are talking about is possible. That's just not the American way. We know that we settle things with ballots and not bullets. And the only time we haven't done that is, you know, 1860, and we still kind of remember what happened there. So I think that the lesson will be, look, if they could do it in such a divisive election in 1800, we can do it in 2020.
Something that's slightly different, and this doesn't correspond to 1800, but the 1930s, there's talking about court packing, of increasing the number of seats of the Supreme Court after the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. What do you think about that, of any parallels from 1930, which it did not happen? Franklin D. Roosevelt did not increase the number of seats on the Supreme Court and appoint more justices in order to be able to have a court that was more amenable to his policies. But there are some people that are talking about that. So what do you think about the plausibility of that after the election?
Yeah, that's a good question. Franklin Roosevelt wanted to pack the court. He was at the height of his power. And no president has been as popular or more popular than Franklin Roosevelt was when he was at the height of his authority. And yet that failed. And it failed, including from people in his own party. And believe me, the Supreme Court, which had been ruling against Roosevelt by close 5-4 decisions and against key pieces of the New Deal, there were a lot of Democrats who really hated the court's rulings, but they wouldn't take that extra step and go with Roosevelt and say, so then let's increase the size of the court and pack it with Roosevelt loyalists. They just wouldn't take that step because, again, there's a constitutional norm, which is the federal judiciary, including the Supreme Court, has to be independent of politics, that it should be making judgments based on law. And even if you disagree with those judgments, it shouldn't be overly politicized. So even within his own party, Roosevelt, and by the way, Roosevelt kept pushing it even after people said, don't do this. He kept pushing, and ultimately the scheme was defeated. So I think that if the Democrats were to win and they get control of the Senate in 2020, I think there'll be people who bring that up, that historical example, and say, well, wait a minute, let's not pull an FDR and overreach. Now, there'll be people in the Democratic Party who say, absolutely, push this as hard as we can and get this done and just ram it through. It will be interesting to see which way public opinion goes. I think that the Democrats will have to be really, that they don't misunderstand public opinion and say, let's push this through. A lot of people, even in their own party, in their own voters, say, but wait a minute, is that tampering with the courts? And should we do that? And you'll hear a lot of those arguments from Republicans for sure if they decide to go forward with something like this.
And one other question to tie this, well, a couple more questions to tie these things together. We had mentioned that 2020 feels strange and alien to a lot of people because their basis of comparison is the post-World War II order, where they're thinking of 1950s and 1970s, 1980s, where there seemed to be more of a common American culture. It could be due to the unifying factors of the Cold War. I'm not exactly sure. And it seems like in these different instances you're talking about, where chaos that could have happened in 1800, which you don't think will happen in 2020, the understanding of precedents and constitutional precedents is an immune system to fight off some of these nastier illnesses and viruses that would try to affect the body politic. What has to happen in order for that immune system to be vigorous? So things don't go wrong like they could have in 1800, but didn't, and hopefully don't go wrong in the future?
I love that question because I think it's exactly the right question because it understands that, you know, James Madison called our American Republic an experiment in self-government. And experiments get conducted, and sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fail. The idea that America could actually fail as an experiment, we need to take that really seriously, which means we need to keep educating ourselves and particularly the younger generations in these constitutional principles and constitutional norms so that they don't think, well, if you lose an election, it's okay to go out and just be violent. And let's overturn things the way lots of other countries around the world that happens after elections. But that only doesn't happen in America because the people have absorbed these principles and absorbed these lessons from history. And they say, oh, wait, that's not the American way of doing things. Let's do it the right way. So I think this continued success of the, and I love the way you put it, the sort of immunities to diseases and bad viruses in the body politic, that's a great way of saying it, because that immunity is built up by education, by you know, listening to this kind of a podcast, by studying these things in school, and by understanding these constitutional principles and saying, hey, whoa, whoa, no matter what happens, we're all Americans here. We all share certain principles, and it's got to be those things that guide us, especially in moments of conflict and crisis.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. All right, well, that is a lot of what you do, education as well. You are the director of the Ashbrook Center. So if people want to follow up with what you're doing, Jeff, where's the best place to find you online and learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, we are online at ashbrook.org. A-S-H-B-R-O-O-K, ashbrook.org, where we have all kinds of great resources for students, teachers, and citizens. We're located at on Ashland University's campus in Ashland, Ohio, but we have programs across the country, really, in for students, teachers, and citizens. And we really focus on the idea of educating our fellow Americans in the history and principles of our country. Because look, politics matters, elections matter, definitely, policy matters, law matters, but we think all of those things, ultimately, that politics is downstream from culture, and that culture really shapes politics, and education really profoundly shapes culture. So we say we're in the freedom business, which is educating Americans to understand the principles of freedom and govern themselves as individuals and as a nation. And so we try to provide the educational resources for them to be able to do that. And we do it around the country. So, you know, your listeners are welcome to check us out at ashbrook.org. And we've got another great website for people who are teachers or for parents, for example, who might be homeschooling their kids now, called teachingamericanhistory.org, TAH.org. Great site with all kinds of primary source materials and helpful study guides and questions for to really dig deep into American history and government.
All right. Well, people can check that out there. I'll link to this in the show notes. And really appreciate you coming on and sharing all this with us. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
There we go. That wraps up everything for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.